And tonight, I believe, is which would you rather be or a wasp? I have a guilty part. We could actually start with it. We might as well get rid of it. If we take it with a bee, in general, it seems to me to be a social creature. And there are some solitary bees that we should ignore. And there are some community wasps that we should ignore. We will have community bees and solitary wasps. We'll have the aspid wasps, who sting. Wasps are much more bad-tempered than bees, generally. So should we rather be good-tempered or bad-tempered? Get us a license to smile. Ken suggests we should talk about silence tonight. I think what we'll do is fold our hands and do the Hawaiian school of yoga technique of being silent about talking instead for 3 hours. I think I'll take Mr. Watson's question actually about ideas and what they are from another angle. We've talked about this before. We've said that ideas are forms, and we've also said the tendency is to intellectualize everything we say, and particularly to intellectualize intellectual propositions as if they were merely intellectual propositions. To think that ideas are only ideas. But if we take the word idea and split it, as we've done before, into a point of division, the id, and a primary spiritual substance, the air, which is the same air in the word earth, we will define an idea as a division in a primary spiritual substance. If we let the paper represent spirit, and any circumscription represent an idea, we see that an idea is actually a zoning, circumscribing, enclosing, covering of a portion of infinite spirit. When we say portion, we immediately invoke the pilar again. See, we've made a door here because we made a finite, and we've made a pi r function, a circumscription process. Every finite is a door to infinity, both ways. That is, you can start from infinity, pop it to finite, and then let the infinite spirit function through that finite. Or you can identify yourself on the underside of the finite and then consider the finite as a doorway back to the infinite. Our physical bodies are such finites and therefore can be considered as ideas. Remember, we have to be on guard against mere intellectualism, and we have to remember that an idea is spirit formulating. We say formulating, not formulated, because the essential character of spirit is dynamic. Spirit can never become static, and therefore every function of spirit is in the progressive form of the verb. It is a doing, not a done. If we take a done, we're really making an illegitimate abstraction and pretending there is a finited end process completed and therefore made static. No such thing exists. If we now look at the infinity of ideas, we cover the paper as we have done before with circles all over. Each circle represents the limit of a formulating force of spirit, but all the limits transcend each other. They go beyond each other, they mutually interpenetrate each other. This is a bit of G.G. Moody. This is the interpenetration of all beings and the reciprocal feeding of all beings. An impulse, a point of impact in infinite spirit, starts a ripple process, and it would go to infinity if it were not for the fact that other parts of the infinite are also positing impulses, and the impulses then stand as limiting factors to each other. Let's take two circles. The center of each circle is on the perimeter of the other. A primary impact, that's the initiation point of a ripple system which spreads out, and if there were no other point it would spread to infinity, and then that point would never know itself and could never reflect upon its own nature. The fact that in infinity other points are posited means that the ripple started from a given point, A, passes through space, but when it reaches the impulse point B, it is reflected back to A. This means that A has a means whereby it can know what it has sent out because the point B returns the motion that A has emitted. The same thing goes on from the side of B. B sends out a ripple, and that ripple goes to the point A, and the impulse point A reflects it back to B. Now we see here that we have, in this simple diagram, two impulse centers and two zones, one dominated by the form A, one dominated by the form B. But a large portion of these two circles is free in this diagram. This is an abstract diagram. So in the one case, a lot of A is free from B, and in the other case, a lot of B is free from A. But in between the two, there is a zone where A and B concur. They concur together because the ripples from A and B overlap there. This is then a contested zone. If a person identifies himself with center A, and by supreme concentration keeps himself only on the center A, all he will feel is that a motion initiated by him goes out and returns to him. The nature of the thing that returns is he will not know if he is concentrated fully on the impulse point A, because what he will know on the return is simply the assimilable of A, the motion he sent out. In other words, his own motion will return and he will be aware of it. Remember, we can only know the thing to which we are tuned. So if we tune or concentrate or identify with A, the motion A going out and returning from point B will assimilate with A, and its backflowing motion will cause what we call recognition. The nature of the reflecting surface B will not be known. If we then concentrate not on A but on B, the same thing will happen, only now the content of consciousness will be B sending out a message and recognizing the nature of what has been sent out. But if we identify with the space between these two centers, we will have simultaneously presented motions A and B, and a resultant pattern, a significance will arise from A and B, a new emergence, something that is not only A and B but a resultant. It's in this zone that a gestalt arises, something more than the constituent parts, a unity bigger than its mere constituents, considered as a totality. If we now turn this diagram for a moment and let the one center and the other center represent, in the one case, idea, we call it B, and the other one, energy, action, we call it A. And we'll let the spinal column be drawn between the two, so the top of it represents the head and the bottom of it the base of the spine. The base of the spine will represent the activist centers, particularly the sexual and appetite urges, and the top center will represent the intellective process. Now, between the two centers will arise a contested zone in which idea and action tendency will be simultaneously presented. That roughly, schematically, is what goes on inside a human being. An idea is spiritual force. It is not merely an idea, understood in the ordinary sense as a shadow only in the mind. It is a spiritual force, and it has a definite form, a shape, and consequently it can integrate with another one. Now, it not only can do, but it has inside itself a definite tendency to do so. From the point of view of sentiency, it has a desire to do so. If we take a triangle, and another triangle, and another one, and another. If we put six triangles in a box and shape them about a bit, they will tend to assume a definite relation with each other. And they will establish themselves in a pattern. This has to do with the shape of those things. If we take another box, when we put a triangle in and a circle made of wood and shape them about, the relationship will not have the same necessity as the one in which the triangles only occur. So mechanically we can say there's a definite relationship between the triangles that does not exist between triangle and circle. Now in the same way, there is a definite relationship between all our ideas, such that when the mind is being stimulated or rattled, the skull is the box. When the mind is being rattled within the skull, the ideas therein are rattled and tend to form patterns. Now, when people think that they're thinking, they think erroneously that they are controlling the pattern that is being made by the ideas they're examining. But in fact, that is a very, very rare capacity, to be able to make an idea go into a place by act of will, regardless of its form, argues a very high degree of volitional control. The tendency of all the ideas in the mind is to go quite mechanically into associated patterns and there to cohere and build up an integrated unity. Now, we said that every idea could be considered as a doorway both ways. From the point of view of infinity, such a doorway is a conditioning factor. The infinite force coming into that doorway propagates through it and takes the shape of the form to which it comes. So if we make another shape of door, this is a unity shape of door, and spirit goes through that door, it will come out like some of the macaroni things that you get sometimes. The finite form is a conditioning factor for infinite spirit. This means that if we invoke spirit and we have in our mind a given idea, the idea will condition the manifestation of the spirit as it comes through. So, if we have already a finite pattern, of which we are very fond, and we say our prayers and require the infinite spirit, we claim the promise, as they say now and there, and the spirit comes through, then it can only come through in the peculiar form that we have set, with all the internal inconsistencies of an inadequately analysed idea. So that we cannot know what infinite spirit would have us do if in fact we are already identified with a finite form which has its own purpose, its own direction. You know, when Christ made the Lord's Prayer, he said you should pray in this manner, and the whole of the prayer is completely devoid of individuated purposes. It's thy kingdom come, this infinite absolute. And the individuated form of the praying person is ignored, cut out, get rid of it. Now some people do both of these things at once. They say, I would like a new spare tire to replace the old one, which is the other verse. But if it be contrary to thy will, O Lord, let it not be so. Now she's doing both at once. They are conditioning the incarnate spirit and making a mental reservation for it in case it doesn't want to come through. This is a kind of parleying with oneself, more than complete exposure of one's own field to the infinite. What we have to see is that as long as we have a finite idea, a finite purpose in our finite organism, and use that as a reference when praying to the infinite, all we're doing, in fact, is putting a filter up so that whatever does come through will be determined by our form and not by the will of the absolute. And unless our form is perfectly self-consistent, which it very seldom is, it means that we are requiring a force to come into a self-contradictory system. It will come in, because you ask it to, but it will come into a self-contradictory system and sow the seeds of the disintegration of the form that has set the purpose. This is why it is said, when you pray, be very, very careful, because your prayers may be answered. Now, from the point of view of the door below, if we consider an idea in the mind, and we look up to it, as we tend to have an idea, and we think of ourselves somewhat below the idea, and then we try to think of the infinite through the filter of the idea, then we are imposing on the infinite the form of the idea through which we think about it. Let's pretend for a moment we'll draw one of those funny kinds of stars that are made of two squares. Very awkward to draw, really. Like a halite star, right? Made of two squares interlaced. Suppose when we think that this is the symbol of God. So we say, I am praying to this kind of door today, and therefore I am calling on a double four-square God. Now, all that can come through from the infinite to us is going to be conditioned by this, as in an act of prayer. But now, we are going to impose on the infinite the form of the concept. So when we are relating ourselves to that God, we are, in fact, conditioning our own organism to act as if there were such a God. The purpose of talking about non-duality is to get rid of all these forms and allow the infinite to speak for itself. Christ says God is spirit and has to be worshipped in spirit and truth. Truth is form, I've had that before, and spirit is the cause of that form. And we have to worship in the cause and in the effect. We have to worship the cause, that's the absolute free initiative, and truth means this wheel which brings to be, establishes, and then the final H on the end, which is in the Hebrew Torah, the head, breathes off the whole form back again into infinity. So in truth we have the generation of a wheel, the entrance of spirit into that wheel, and its back breathing into the infinite. This completes the process. It's the good old symbol of Taurus again, with the cross in it. Every idea as a form conditions behavior, and if there were only one idea, the being would continuously behave in the same manner. Because of stimulation from various sources, we would say A, stimulation, accidental, B, stimulation, traditional, religious. Because of these two sources of stimuli, into the being are inserted various forms. And the forms inside wrestle with each other. There are spirits, and each spirit, conditioned by a form, strives to establish itself inside the individual. Now, the individual is passive to this conflict. We see this most manifestly in the case of a mentally disordered, where quite obviously they are not able to control the ideas. If we take a schizophrenic type, we will find that the mind of that person has ideas, so maybe an idea of a triangle and a square and a circle and another symbol and so on. These ideas in the mind are factually vibrating with their own forms throughout the whole mind, and there's a hole in the floor of it, and down that hole goes the spinal cord to activate the body. So the conflict that is going on there resolves itself in the victory of the strongest, and the strongest overcomes the others and then send the message down the spine into action. But a very old saying says, the whip passes momently from hand to hand. If at one moment the lunar crescent has gained the victory and sent down the message, praise the moon, and all things fantastic, like crayfish and howling dogs, then after having done so, it has expended its finite energy and time. And as soon as its energy falls below a certain level, another form, the next one in the hierarchy, dominates, and suddenly there is triangulation behavior broadcast. And because of this continuous overthrow of one form by the other in the mind, and the lack of a proper coordinating form, the behavior of the person is unpredictable, and therefore he's said to be separate from the split mind. When you talk to such a person, you can divert him off a given form which you see is starting to manifest by deliberately taking an associated form, knowing that the association is sufficient to establish an energy net. That if you take this crescent here and notice that the crescent is a part of the circle over here, you can talk about the full moon to a man who is talking about the crescent moon. A man is talking about the new moon. And what the new moon means, it means turn your money over. And you can say to him, the new moon is really a thin edge of the whole moon. And the whole moon means count all of it, not just a bit of it. So we pass from one idea to an associated idea, and thus establish a link across. Already we've taken the first step to defeating this schizophrenic state. Now, if we then say the circle here has a center, and through that center we can draw a vertical and a horizontal, we can then see some sort of necessary relation between the curved line and the straight. But we can then point out that this straight line is very like this straight line on the square, and this horizontal straight line is like this other one on the square. And if we turn them both over like that, we see the cross again, but we move this one of the cross from above and put it down here below, it will make a square. Now we can link the square to the cross. Again, we have established a relation in this part of the mind. That is the general method of integrating a split mind, by passing from a form to similar forms, and never trying to pass from a form to another totally unlinked, but always manufacturing a link. And thus, through the linked form, tying together the unlinked, always through the similar element. This is again this contested zone. This contested zone can link together the prime drive, the energy, and the idea. In the contested zone, the idea and the prime drive result in a process of worry, emotional apprehension. But if you actually penetrate into a state of worry and emotion, you'll always find simultaneously presenting a desire to do something and an idea of what ought to be done. So whereas when you concentrate on an idea completely, you will present yourself as a form, the dynamic aspect of which will tend to lack. And when you concentrate on an urge, you will fail to see the form in it. Yet if you concentrate on the emotional zone between, you will discover that the idea and the urge present themselves simultaneously together in that contested zone. And in that, then, you can see the meaning of the idea in relation to the urge. We have to stress this very carefully, that the idea is not nothing. It is energy. And insofar as that idea is characterized, it is already conditioned in the mode of its operation, has definite preferences, and these preferences carry the being along into action. In other words, the ideas are conditioning factors of human behavior. You might have had a slim booklet under your doorway recently from the MRA. Bookman's Moral Rearmament. You'll notice, if you bother to open it, that a straight statement was made there that in World War III there is a simple opposition between communism on the one side which is Marxism, and a slight twist of it, on the other side, moral rearmament, and that these two forces, which are really identical forces, are in opposition, and one is pretending to be superior to the other. Now, the communists are trained to believe in a materialistic active process of differentiating the world. The other ones are believing that there's a materialistic reason for present action. You must now differentiate and activate yourself like the Marxists if you are to survive over against the Marxists. It's really an identical concept disguised, and because the Marxists have chosen to stress the material aspect and economic welfare and have taken over the Christian commune as the justification of themselves, all well-indoctrinated Marxists will tell you that the early Christians were communists because they lived in communes. So in the very same way, the businessmen of the West, realizing that they are threatened in certain ways, want an ideological unity as the center of integration for the armed forces of the West to balance those of the communist East. Now the two are really identical forces, simply with the changes rung on the turn. You'll notice that Buffon himself said that when he was thinking about the state of the world, he was presented with an alternative. And he put it down as communism or moral and spiritual rearmament. But then he chose moral rearmament, not spiritual rearmament. Now you know that moral is form, that the form is a mode of behaviour for some definite material end, as you know by the MR function in morality. It's a mode of differentiating something. It has to do with economy at the material level. Now spirit has to do with something quite other than that. His worship is perfect freedom, is the statement in the Bible. If Buchmann had said, we will oppose communism by stigmatizing it as bondage, and we will have spiritual freedom in opposition to materialistic bondage, it would have been a lot better, more effective in fact. But because of the financial backing behind it and its source, they want to keep up this moral concept, because out of it they are quite sure they'll be better off with the workers. If they can make the workers conscious, morally, that is of their social duty, which means their social duty to the commune as an economic production unit, then they are more likely to get something out of them, in their sense, than if they teach them that there is transcendent spirit above these two things, and this transcendent spirit is absolutely unpredictable, such that it blows where it lists. You can hear it going by, but you don't know where it came from or is going to. And he says, so is everyone born of the Spirit. So you cannot guarantee, it's very sad this, you cannot guarantee that a spiritually conscious man will actually arrive to blow that C sharp on the trumpet at 7:30 precisely, because he might be moved by the Spirit not to go. Now all those people who like other people to be reliable prefer the concept of morality, whereas those, and they are not people, those persons who believe that to become free is the real significance of the evolution through matter of spirit, are necessarily unpredictable. There's nothing wrong in being unpredictable, because the unpredictable person, the really unpredictable person, is never inimical to anything or anyone. It is the predictable person that's really evil. Because if you can condition a person into a moral behaviour pattern, that is, you circumscribe him with a form, and then you strike on that form with the appropriate stimulus, you can produce a reaction of violence out of him, purely mechanical. With a person of spirit who is free, you cannot do that. When you give him a stimulus, it isn't your marvellous Pavlovian education that has given you supremacy over him. But he looks at the stimulus as it comes in and says, this is a stimulus in X10295. And that's all you hear out of it. You can't do anything about it. So the man of spirit is completely indeterminate, cannot be constrained, and therefore cannot do as an organized body of resistance to this leftist, Marxist, which is communist group. In order to defeat any structure whatever, by the law of equal and opposite action, reaction, you must have an entity at the same level. It is quite useless opposing the Marxist communists with a non-materialistic ideology, because that would not be on the level of Marxism. In consequence, you couldn't guarantee that the people that accepted this freedom would be there on the battlefield on the day to fight for the cause. They might be busy composing a sonnet in the cellar or something. Now, it's this total unpredictability of spirit that is contested and hated by the powers of the materialistic world. When Christ says you cannot serve simultaneously your mother, you count where your mother counts, and your father, of course, you happen to be a spirit. You can't serve those two together. One of them means to count the materialistic situation and to work from there. The other means to be free, not to count at all. Because spirit is continuous, is not discrete, therefore is not analyzable before the fact. It is immediate. That without mediation. In the Bible it says that when God gives his spirit, he always gives it fully, without measure. He doesn't put it in pecks and perkins and things. Okay? It just comes through fully. Whereas the opposite of it is to count the little discrete benefits of matter, and then to compute out of all these things which one you'd rather fight for. The two methods are in complete opposition. The lower one only, really, strictly is a method, and the top one is really a hetad. And it's very, very rare, we hear a lot about method and very, very little about hetad. Remember now that the spirit is itself an eternally formulating force, but in spirit, the forces are all mutually penetrating and propagating to infinity, each one of them, so that at infinity, all those different motions interpenetrate each other absolutely. So that at infinity, if that is Tom down there, and that's Dick, and that's Harry, and that's Vicente, at infinity, all is Tom, Dick, Harry, simultaneously. In the finite world, these three senses are separated out. You can decide which is Tom, or which is Dick, and which is Harry in the three-part man at your leisure. You give a hint and say that Harry is in the heart. The other two are difficult to work out. Notice that in this diagram, that when we get the compasses, I'm going to prove now that I'm not cheating. I'll actually use the compasses, I think. And show that I personally am not falsifying the evidence. When we put the circle with the compasses in this manner, in order to make three, you know how to polish it off in any time. In order to make three, we have to have three centers. And the result is three separate circles that are manifestly not coincident. Now imagine that the ripple from any one of those centers passes out at right angles, a radius, and hits on the perimeter of another one. It will start reflecting. It's already reflected from the center, and now reflects from the perimeter of any other one. And it's very important to notice what happens in this diagram, because it is not merely a figure of speech, which is an actual diagram of the little function of the macrocosmic unity. You notice that each one of these circles touches two of the others, and again, if we go through to the turn of another ripple, another reflection point, we will see immediately that the whole structure is tending to lose its discrete circular behavior and become more of a unity. You notice now that the difference between these circles is diminishing. I'll open it out for another little now. Now you can see that the whole structure is losing its discrete form. And it's beginning to approximate here more and more and more towards the circle. You see the great depth here of the beginner circle, the great depth here, it becomes flatter here. Flatter still here, and it's becoming there, flatter still. You can see that at infinity, all these ripples coincide exactly, which means that it is only at this precipitated or saturnine compressed earthly level that separation exists at all. So at the other end of the infinite end, that's a rather little joke, the infinite end, at the other end, all the circles are not closed. They vibrate exactly on each other. And it is only as they come internally they differentiate themselves out into these three obviously separated circles. Now, if we say some for primary Erd and Victor Richard, intellectual boy who knows what he's doing, and Harry for the high afternoon and a half. Here is our three part being in the gross material world, with the three parts separated out, and because of identification with this first level, the three are necessarily separated. But if we go out to infinity, these three concur and are absolutely simultaneous. And therefore we say of Spirit, of God, that with Him, action, thinking and feeling are absolutely simultaneous. Now we can only get this by non-identification of the gross material body. As soon as you identify with the physical body, you will find in it finite points of stress strain. You will find that some parts of the body are more tense than others, and they will focus the attention on them. And as soon as that happens, if you are not careful, a certain form and modal operation of energy will occur, and then you will be either just urging without thinking or feeling, or you will be feeling emotionally without thinking or urging, or you will be thinking without ever having any feeling compassion or any drive power. And these things necessarily occur in a state of separation in the gross material body. So we see a strange fact by this geometrical demonstration that things that are identical at infinity precipitate differences at their centers from the very nature of geometrical operation. In other words, if we make one big circle and let it vibrate, as the vibrations are coming in, the ripples are coming in from this, imagine this static vibrant impulse, the largest circle that we can see. Imagine it to stand for a moment, because there's nothing outside it, and therefore nothing to measure possible motion against. So we'll consider it for the moment as if it were standing, but in fact it is not static in the Gerson theory sense, but merely has no external body with which to measure its motion against. Now imagine that being sphere simply to pulse. That pulsation is not a rotation, it's simply that the whole structure pulses. And in the act of pulsing, through the surface of that sphere, there travel ripple structures. And as they're traveling, they separate out, and the nearer they come to the centre, the more separate they become. So by the mutual interference of successive impulsations that are identical on the outside, by ripple interference going inwards, they precipitate separate centres on the inside. And so the whole field of an individual man, which is not two, not three, not four, precipitates within itself by interference with its own impulses, patterns of behaviour that appear internally, separately. So the only way we can transcend the separation of these three functions is by breaking identification with the physical body and travelling outwards into the field. You can see in this diagram, if we take this three centres from which we started as the three gross material parts of the organism, and we allow any one of them to bisect the angle between the other two, see, as the urge to go between the feeling and the thinking, not to become either feeling or thinking, it will start travelling to infinity. And when it's gone out so far, it will find a band. This band is an inhibiting factor, because we start with finite energy, or we become tired, and there's a ripple structure there being met by an incoming ripple from the internet. At that point we become tired, and we think there is a very strong resistance there. So we tend to retire back to our tongue centre. If we understand what's really happened, and when we're feeling tired we make a special effort, like we do when we have a pain, when we're running. When we run through the pain we go on to second wind. When we've gone on to second wind we come to another barrier. If we run through that one, we'll come to another one. Now by very special efforts, at the point at which we are tired, we can break these limiting factors and move towards this absolute coincidence of feeling, action, thinking. And we can't do it unless we are tired and force our way through it. We can't do it when we're feeling on top of our form and running away with the thing, because really, feeling on top of form at the gross material level is another statement of that mechanical inertia. It means there's a certain amount of energy from the dindin got into the musculature and is running about. And it's felt as a vital direction. But when you're tired and the body doesn't want to move at all, then if you call upon your will, which is something quite other than that energy that wanders about in your muscles from around a piece of cannon, then you transcend the physical limitations of the zone with which you're identifying, and by act of will you discover that there's another level of energy, that you can't find it unless first you tire yourself. The tendency when you're tired, of course, is you have to sleep. And if that happens, you just miss it. Going to sleep is considered to be the biggest obstacle to yoga, that is. But making yourself so tired that you are nearly going to sleep and then fighting it so that you don't is your best friend. There are certain zones in the mind, and when you think about a subject, the brain cells recording that particular system of ideas, like the muscles when you use them, become intoxicated with the byproducts of the thinking process. They then become opaque to further nervous impulses of the same order. You are then tired and you can't think about that subject. But they are only tired relative to nervous impulses as a discrete. Now, if you make a very, very special effort, instead of getting energy of nervous impulses discrete, you suddenly discover a field above those. There's a little flick, and you suddenly become very, very awake again about the same subject, and you suddenly see it illuminated from above, and all the things that were presented serially are now seen to simply be one idea which split itself in coming through that band. You've now got a master concept from which they derive, and it is in the field of that gross impulse series. So first, we take the part of the brain, we start to think, that means to put energy into it, and the energy runs round, and as it's running round the cells, it's saying tinkle, 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 and each little tinkle is a thought. And then, when it's gone round so much, it has intoxicated itself at the serial level, it's got poison as a byproduct of its own thinking process, until it's completely blocked. And until you've had a rest and the blood carried away those poisons, you cannot think further at this serial impulse level. But if you make a very special effort, you suddenly flick onto the next level, non-serial, non-impulsive. Now, if our ideas were in the head only, you stay there, and when we were thinking, we merely said, I'm thinking, that would be all right, it would be truthful. And if when we felt, we were merely aware that we were feeling, that would be all right. If when we urged, we merely urged, that would be all right. But in fact, what happens in an ordinary untrained human being is that when a feeling arises, immediately a thought process is stimulated, caused by the feeling tone of ideas of similar intensity and pleasure pain value. Remember, we've only the two feelings, liking and disliking, pleasure and pain. And when you feel pleased, all pleasant things in the mind begin to resonate. So the feeling triggers off a lot of ideas. Now, this feeling may have arisen from a stimulus of a certain kind, but many of the ideas, in fact most of the ideas, have nothing to do with the extant stimulus situation. And so, we say of the ideas that are roused in the mind that really have nothing to do with the material fact that cause the stimulus of pleasure or pain, all those ideas we call fantasy. They're simply the spreading out like a fan, stimulated from one point. When we get an urge, a simple, say the most simple urge, we have a simple urge to eat, or a simple urge to reproduce, if that urge was seen merely for what it is, an urge to reproduce, there'd be no harm in it at all, because the moment that happened, you would say, well, I'm too busy at the moment to be reproducing, or already I have reproduced 42 times, and so on. When these things occurred in your mind, you would stop it. But in fact, when the urge to reproduce comes, the chemistry arising from the reproductive organs spreads through the body and rouses in the mind memories in the individual of, if it's a man, of all previous pleasant girls ever seen, and not only his, but all ancestral female successful relations. All those crowd up in the mind and then are projected out through the eye onto the object. Now the object is not seen at all. This is why she says that love is blind. A reproductive urge, which is periodic and depends on the consumption of certain foods and certain cosmic radiation, rises, produces this chemical change in the body. This rouses all the individual previous experiences of members of the opposite sex, of the individual and of all his ancestors, produces a highly complex image, and then projects that out onto the present short-lived, fine-toned, straight-haired, whatever it is. In other words, all this is superimposition of ancestral imagery, what Jung would call archetypal energies, and obscures the external fact completely. And for the time being, that person, identified with the thought processes, has no critical faculty whatever, and is then driven into a reproductive relation. And yet what he gets out of the reproductive relation has practically nothing in common with the thing into which that relation is entered. Four, that's something. So, when we understand this elementary principle, the centre of a being is immanent spirit, beyond this is transcendent spirit, and the spirit is running underneath the action man, but in the action man are all the memories of all the experiences that that protoplasm has ever had. When we say that protoplasm, we mean something transcending the individual, because your protoplasm, remember, is part of the original protoplasm of your parents and contains in itself the memories of your parents' experiences. So that protoplasm, which is specialized in you as the somatic part, the body part, and the other part that has remained for sexual cell generation, is derived from the first human ancestors and carries with it all these memories. Now, therefore, in the action band of any individual, there is much more than an individual experience complex, there's a total ancestral complex experience. And when an external stimulus comes to it, it strikes upon it, and whatever can resonate harmonically with the stimulus in here, in the action band, is set up and starts to be moving in relation to the stimulus. And the individual, because he's identified with only a tiny little bit of that, the bit that he knows about since he was born, and went to school and learned to recognize himself by name, which is a very tiny amount, because it's only a tiny amount, he tries to interpret this stimulus from that little bit. Now, it cannot work. An individual identified with the formal pattern inside him, derived only from the experience of his life since he was extruded from his mother, is literally deficient in data for interpreting correctly that stimulus. And in fact, he is imposed upon by colossal fields of energies from the totality of all his entities. Now, each little form of action in the action band is an idea. Each idea is a modal operation of spirit. As form, it is orientated to other forms. This is the same thing we say, it resonates with forms of certain harmonic relations. And consequently, when a stimulus comes, a stimulus already being formally characterized necessarily induces formal changes of idea in the being, and yet very, very, very little of that formal change is known by the waking individual, because he's only identified with a few chief memories derived since he was born. So he cannot handle the colossal amount of idea reaction. And when we remember that there is no idea that hasn't got a feeling tone, then every idea is either present or unpresent in relation to another idea. If the two ideas can assimilate together, they posit together, then it feels pleasant, the fact that they fit together. If they won't assimilate, they feel unpleasant. But because when a man is identified with this little small portion of his individual experience and his own birth, he has put a super stress on certain form. When the stimulus comes, that part of the stimulus, which is similar to the part with which he is identified, causes him to like that part of the stimulus. He, from that little tiny part of his own being, now tries to move towards the stimulus and tries to carry with him the unconscious, the totality of all the forms of his ancestry. And a few million of those don't like what he's doing. Now, this is the chief cause of the failure of people when they make New Year resolutions. A little tiny bit of that person has been stimulated painfully, and a little decision is made that we shall never subject ourselves to that thing because it is horrible. But a colossal weight of ancestral the experience in imagery is still orientated towards that very thing about which the new year resolution has been made. So in effect, the new year resolution is framed for being focused. It is made by a very, very tiny part of the being, and funnily enough, generally when the stomach is being surcharged with some fluid and so on, so that the blood, which belongs generally in the head, must come down into the belly and is very busy trying to digest a very excessive amount of food. And so the person is in no mental condition to make a decision about anything, and he feels what he thought full of well-being, or fitness good. And in this feeling of indolence and sensuality and so on, he feels all right with the world, because his belly is intended. So, the man who lives down here says, I feel very kindly disposed, I will make me a resolution. And I shall be kind to all beings after the end of the first. But very, very shortly after this, he doesn't get the same amount of food. Some contracts again. And then the internal tissues begin to rub on each other a bit. There's a little bit of irritation there. Now, as soon as the energy begins to withdraw from there and climb up into the head, then the complete stupidity of that good resolution can be manifest. Because he promised to be kind to Aunt Matilda, who is known intellectual to be a drift of the highest order, and therefore the resolution should never have been made. And this is the kind of mechanical process that goes on. Until we learn to see that where the energies are in the physical body, their separateness, triggers off the ancestral parts of the action band related to that given part of the organism, we cannot begin to control it. If you put your mind on your navel, a good yoga power, you will learn certain things about yourself. If you put it between your eyebrows, you will learn something else. Because in each part of the body there are cells dedicated to certain functions. When you identify with those cells, those functions begin to color the content of consciousness. And you then feel and think that you can do certain things. But if in the middle of a meditation your ear is suddenly stimulated by a backfire from a car, you feel a little jolt down the nose, and suddenly you've left that centre and gone into another centre. Now each centre in the body is the home of an idea. That's why we say the reproductive centre has the idea of reproducing. And the idea is not nothing, it's the spirit there and dedicated to a certain function. In the reproductive organs, spirit utters a continual commandment, be fruitful, fill the earth. That is going on all the time there. And in the head, another spirit is saying, and subdue it. Each part of the body has a commandment given to it by spirit. The commandment is not given a long time ago when a fellow not called Moses was writing a book. But this command is given into the organism continuously and eternally, and eternity is always making such organisms and formulating, that is, ideating in those centres according to its purpose. And this continuous influx of energy into the being is really the meaning of the commandment given by God. It isn't the question of a commandment coming to Moses, an individual, to some other individual. It is a commandment from infinity to all organisms, at one centre to reproduce, at another centre to love its neighbours, at another centre to subdue and order the earth. So that whenever we have a formal function of an organ in the body, separated by a membrane from another function, we have actually a temple of a given spirit. Now this is the cause of the plurality of gods in ancient religions. If we take, say, Buddhism, you know that Buddha was supposed to have gone to Nirvana, gained his release, and that was the end of that. And it was everybody else's problem to do the same for themselves. But a lot of people didn't manage to do it, and so they said, surely this Buddha must have had compassion for us, so he didn't stay in Nirvana, but he's come out of it. And they began to define qualities of this Gautama who had disappeared, and they defined, say, one quality, Manjushri, knowledge. And they personified that knowledge, and because they had been taught the Buddha had gone to Nirvana, then they said, now there is another one. And they fabricated the doctrine of the Bodhisattva, which is the doctrine that all beings can be divided into two categories: ordinary folk who can't do very well on their own, and others who could gain Nirvana for themselves, and are therefore called Bodhisattva. They are Bodhi or wisdom essences, but they deliberately reject the Nirvana for themselves in order to teach other people. Now, historically, it is said that these Bodhisattvas are simply the abstracted psychological parts of the definition of an attained man, separated out into separate personalities. So that man just to wisdom, have a look at this, compassion, and so on. For each quality in the mind, abstracted from the perfect man concept, a Bodhisattva was set up. Now, it then appeared to scholars in the Western mind that this meant to say these Bodhisattvas didn't exist. They were just figures of speech, personified qualities of a developed man. And this is not true. The infinite is prompting in a given center compassion for all beings. And it is positing in another center truth about all beings. And in another center, it is postulating active relationship between all beings. And each center is an idea of a formal function witnessing itself coming from the non-plural or non-dual, but separating itself out in the center, and thus is a person precipitated in the center of infinity, and separated out, in the manner we described before, in the act of penetrating to the center. So that then all those Bodhisattvas are really embodied in the whole man, only because they actually exist infinitely and make for themselves center. And each person developing inside himself is drawing, when he becomes compassionate, he's drawing on infinite compassion, which entering him is personalizing in him. It isn't a mere figure of speech. Another fellow will concentrate on doing good, asking about changing the situation, taking the dirty water out of the world and putting clean, and so on. And another man will spend a lot of time constructing philosophy. Now, each one of these is a specialized function at the center of the earth world. Again, as an activist, a militarist, a great conqueror, or a great religious compassionate leader, or a great philosophical thinker, and so on. And yet, at infinity, these three are exactly coincident and mutually interpenetrated. This means that if we read, as we generally do in Western books on philosophy, about philosophy and religious philosophy, that the solidified part of an attained man, a superman, or a yogi, or a messiah, the solidified parts are merely figures of speech. This is not true. In the Roman Church, there are a great host of so-called saints to whom people pray. In the Buddhist Church, there are as many Bodhisattvas as there are saints in the Roman temple. There are as many as there are in the Greek pantheon, the great Greek god. Simply because infinity has infinite possibilities, and the infinite possibilities which are simultaneous at the top level separate out in manifestings, and the manifestation mode that they adopt depends upon the need of the material situation in which they are precipitated.
This is why so many of us, of course, can have so many faults in the deep tension and in the mind. You know, to satisfy one act.
Yes. Well, the essential thing about them, in the Greek pantheon, or for that matter, in any other pantheon, we find that the human being through which those forces manifest may have some physical or other disability, and he has something to say from infinity, because he is a specialized or personalized element from infinity. And yet, quite independently of that, he is still his mother's son and his father's son in the material sense. Christ in Gethsemane is meaningless if we merely think of him as an infinite incarnate. And if we remember he was born from a woman with a material body, with material ancestors, we can see that inside his ancestral pattern there must have been millions of forms desiring in him not to be crucified. But it isn't a matter of importance to become free of all these evils at all. The important thing is to find out that contribution that has to be made specially in the human being, and to put all one's energy into that thing, and the others will die. The others die for lack of attention. If we put all the eggs in the one basket, well then, it will grow. And we'll have a basket of chicks that will dominate the whole situation. But if, in the attempt to be a whole man, a finite being with only 70 years before him, were to start studying all the various knowledges of the human race, all he would become would be deficient in all of them. To perfect oneself and retain one's uniqueness is the same thing as building a pyramid within. It's that concept for its own work. And to steal the energy of all the other things for that thing. When it is gained, it then radiates through the whole being and unifies the being. And then identified as infinity, all the things that were lost are gained. So that one then knows all about the subjects that one ignored, and one has specialized in one subject which one did not ignore. And really, in that sense, it makes the change significant that one should know something about everything and everything about something, which is possible at infinity. But only by superior concentration at the material end on one of those things. So to reduce it very simply, we take our three-part man, we make ourselves aware of the fact that we have an urge working through us. But we know that that urge doesn't belong to the individual as such, because it is a command from infinity to reproduce and to eat towards the end. From another center comes a command to be compassionate, heal for all beings. From another one comes think consistently, which is the same thing as consistency. And those three main centers in the being, and they are separated out, are really three persons of the Trinity and God. If we then move backwards from them whilst watching them very carefully and try to make them all into one, not by confusion of them, but by simultaneous presentation of them, then we gain the unity we want. We haven't got to make the idea like an end. We have to make the idea so clear and so untouched by urge or feeling that it is an adequate guide for the urge and the feeling. We haven't got to put an idea in the urge, that would weaken. We have to get the urge so much under control that its full force can be held by its will, and then the pattern of the idea be used to guide that full force of being. We haven't got yet a feeling of absolute compassion obscured by an idea and an end, but we have to get the feeling of absolute compassion in its purity, and then see what is the form of the situation, and then take our will and apply in that situation such formal patterns of behaviour that are fitting for what compassion dictates in that situation. There's one thing here about faithful in little, faithful in much. In order to consolidate things that we know, we have to force them into the growth of the world. If we make a promise to ourselves, remember the promise is made by a very, very tiny little bit of us at first. And the tendency of that little thing is to make a very, very big promise. Because a very big promise makes it very, very significant. It would rather promise a very big world-shaping event than a little one. So, in order to be faithful in much, we must first be faithful in little. You take one little thing, you make a promise. It can be as small as you like and as insignificant as you like. Promise yourself that you will hold your little finger bent all day. This is the meaning of being in practice. If you can remember to do it, that is the thing. You set a given form only in order to practice remembering. It doesn't matter what it is. Promise yourself that you'll touch your button hole once every hour. So that's typically, so that people don't think they're nuts. But you do it. If you can make yourself do just a simple little act like that, you have laid the foundation of the big one. But if you think that is too small for you, you will never do it. So define for yourself some very, very tiny little victory, so very, very small that you wouldn't dare boast about them. We've had some exceptions there every Friday at 3:15. I won't go and tell anybody. I said to somebody, I kept myself there at 3:15. He said, so what? The whole importance of it is actually to be able to say, I will do it. There's a funny kind of talk inside of that keeps biological time. Everybody knows they've got one because when it's holiday time in the morning, you don't need an alarm clock. Or when young men have a girlfriend to meet early in the morning before going to work, they wake up. And this evidence is biological time. See if you can rediscover it. Biological time is present when you're going on holidays and when you've got a girlfriend. But it's present all the time but doesn't function. Now see if you can promise yourself by saying, I will use my biological time. And without looking at the ordinary clock, at 11 o'clock, I will check my right ear. Actually, if I deliver, at first you will find that you keep wondering whether it's nearly 11 o'clock or not. Now that wondering has nothing to do with biological time, it has to do with this thinker, which is not the biological time keeper. You can get in contact with that biological time simply by a positive statement that it exists. And you are saying to it, give me a ring at 5:00 to 3:00. And concentrate then on the work you are doing and forget about it. And quite suddenly at 5:00 to 3:00, something will go like that. And that is biological time. And you can get in contact with it. Now, this biological time is very, very important because it happens to be the harmonic of a time related to cosmic time, which helps you to transcend the individual in very special ways. First of all, find that the ordinary method, just telling yourself, if you will touch a simple thing like a button, in 1 hour from now, look at the clock, see what happens. And then don't look at the clock again, and don't think about it. Get on with your work, this is the essential part of it. You must assume that something is repeated. You must assume that in 1 hour it will suddenly come into your mind. when you say it's time to do that, then look at the clock. Now you'll be surprised how near you can come to that. When you can do very tiny things like that, then you'll begin to believe. Now the purpose of succeeding in a tiny thing is only to convince you that certain things exist. If you try to do something too big, you'll be convinced that things don't exist. If you do a very tiny little thing and think about it, you say, the mere fact that I didn't look at the clock, yes, I went like that and looked, it was dead on, but I, that means that by another time it exists, I live today. When you become convinced of this, you become aware that there is a certain kind of rhythm. Just in the same way that a hibernating animal will say, I'll go to sleep now, and when the spring comes, the temperature will rise to a certain level, and I will wake up. And it does so. It's all rests in this fundamental fact of assumption. Assumption is another aspect of memory. You have to be absolutely sure that what you are going to do is going to be done. And then, because of your surety, you don't make any attempt to keep it in your mind and think about it, because the mind, the thinking department, is the organ of fear. And if you do think about it, you'll discover you thought about it for a quarter of an hour. And then make an extra effort and thought for half an hour, and then you forgot about it for 4 hours. That's the usual rule. As soon as you think about it, you are using the organ of fear, which is not the organ of assumption at all. That's another organ. And when you use the organ of assumption, the thing will occur, and when you interfere with it, it won't. Now remember, belief is what you love. It's in the word to love. So all of belief is saying is that you like it to be that way. Faith is the energy that you use to lay a path in a given narrative. With assumption, you actually take up this infinite force. You don't lay a path at all. In faith, you're actually treading, expecting the results again. In assumption, you pick your thing up, like you do with a post-hypnotic suggestion. You know, when you hypnotize a person and then say, under hypnosis, at 2:15 in a fortnight's time on Tuesday, you will keep the lady next to you in the bus. And he doesn't. Now, who's been keeping time? Not the secret. But the thing is assumed there, because it is said constantly. No path is laid, but a resonance is set up, and infinity itself watches the whole constellation of forces, and when the thing concurs as defined, it works soon, and that's it. So in assumption, you just pick the thing up out of infinity, and you don't worry about it, and you don't carry on assuming every few minutes. It's just one. It's immediate. Well, biological time existed before the human being existed with a living. The specific organs in the body are very closely related to it. Sexuality is very closely related to it. That's a question of identification then. You can simultaneously assume and think and wonder whether something is really right. Because they're separate forms. You can believe that means that you would love the thing to happen. You can assume that it will happen and simultaneously wonder whether the whole thing is bunk. Because your thinking department can think anything that comes into the input by the whole of your ancestors and you. It's to stop this interference of these different things that the analytical process is so important to see that they're doing so. This is a real use of intellect. Not to gain transcendence, but to separate that which should be separated. The commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery, that is referred to not going to the door who doesn't belong to you. It refers to the fact that your idea must not be allowed to interfere with anything that is not ideal. Thinking must not be allowed to stop assumption. It mustn't be allowed to stop feeling. It mustn't be allowed to stop hurt. All functions must be themselves, peculiarly, purely. That is non-adulterated. If I were selling water to you, pure water, and you found it cloudy, and you said, this is cloudy water, and I said, stop milking. You see, you say, you have adulterated my water. If I was selling you milk and you found water, you say, you've adulterated my milk. Now, it depends what you want. To adulterate is to add something to it so that you spoil its ultimate nature. Thinking must be thinking. Feeling must be feeling. Urging must be urging. These three must be kept completely separate and coordinated at infinity by non-identification. Well, you can't concentrate other than in the now, can you?
No.
Concentration next week doesn't work. Well, that's the best thing to do to avoid that is get up a visible control. Write on a postcard what it is you're supposed to be thinking about.